Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to my podcast. And I know it's been over a month, so I apologize for that. But this conversation with Jamie and Christian will make up for everything. We had a really good conversation about his path from the States to Italy, taking Trieste, which was in second division last year, to first division this year. We talked about the struggles he went through early on, the learning curve he had to go through. We talked about leadership. We talked a lot about many different things. I think this conversation is very valuable. Jamian portrayed his art of communication. We talked about communication, obviously, because I also love this topic, but Jamian obviously is a very good communicator, and I think you will enjoy this conversation. We also had a segment with ProBallers.com, which is obviously my sponsor, and everybody in the basketball business should know ProBallers.com. Go visit there right now. And please subscribe. If you're not a subscriber, please share this podcast with especially American coaches. I think it's very interesting perspective. And I'm sure people in Europe will know more about Jamie and Christian very soon. Thanks for being here and see you soon. What's up, Jamie?
What's going on, Menace? How are you?
I'm good. We're going in blind, like I said before. We've never talked on the phone. We're just going to roll with the punches.
I love it, man. I love a good opportunity to see how professional we can be and no chance to choreograph it before.
No, I think it's not so much about the professionals. It's more about the humanistic part, the human part, just the transparency and just roll with the punches, just being open and not really, you know, like people, it's more difficult when people are complex and try to be something they're not, and then it just kind of it feels unnatural. But I think when we were texting, it just started to flow right away. So I think it's going to be a natural one.
Yeah, well, I'm like really excited to ask you a ton of questions as well, because I think you're traveling the world, seeing basketball through a different lens. Hopefully I'll be a good guest. But I'm always super curious, so I'm looking forward to our interaction.
Yeah, let's go back and forth. I'm curious to hear some of your questions, because usually the guests are, I had some questions before from guests that are also curious, but normally it's, you know, I try to hold a conversation, and I believe I can hold a conversation. Otherwise, it's a big part of my job too, to be able to hold a conversation. So, but for the people who may not know you outside of Italy, I think, you know, like it's not, people who have not followed Trieste and have not followed you, they might not be aware. So who is Jamie and Christian?
Man, now that is a complicated question. If you'd asked me, you know, 4 years ago, you know, I would have said I'm a college basketball coach on the way to trying to become one of the best who had an opportunity to do it, you know? And I was, you know, I was 10 years as a college basketball coach. I was a head coach at Mount St. Mary's at 29 years old. I was a head coach at Siena College. And then I was also the head coach at George Washington for 3 seasons. And I got fortunate with a podcast guest, Michael Archieri, who is my GM here at Trieste. Just kind of working the world of media and trying to, you know, like you're doing, trying to share positive stories, positive information for people, give hope for people in our sport. Michael was a guest on my show. And when he made the move to Trieste, he had a job opening, and I was the first person that he called about it. So I was really excited about the opportunity. I didn't know anything about Italy. I didn't know anything about Italian basketball. I didn't know anything about Trieste. And we got here a year ago, and we found a way to gain the promotion in the first season and back into the top division, which is an incredible, incredible thing, man. I mean, you know this, but not a lot of basketball people back home understand to be a part of a promotion is just incredible. And it's a big part of European sport that we don't understand in the States. Yeah. But gain the promotion. And then this year we're sitting right now in fifth or sixth place in one of the top domestic leagues in the world. And you know, we have a chance to really make some noise at the end of the season. So who's Jamie and Christian? I'm a guy who believes in connection being our gift. I'm a supporter of big ideas. I'm a person who believes in standing tall for people who are trying to learn and trying to figure it out. And I'm a person who I believe is a coach, and I love being a coach and coaching others.
Yeah, that's there's so many things I want to hit on. And like you said, like you answered at the end, like who, because I want the person, you know, I want to know, like people can look up where you coached at, and we're going to talk about the transition, you know, from college basketball to Europe, because there's so many cultural lessons, I think, that can you can pass on to people who are also American coaches, especially who want to come over, but also coaches who are here and may not have that understanding of what it takes to really adjust to a new culture. But in terms of your we're going to get to that part. That's one thing I want to separate in my mind. I got some things that I've put together. But in terms of your past, what shaped you as a person that you became, that shapes you as a coach now? So what are like some things in your childhood or some things in the past that you kind of like left such a mark on you that you have to pass it on as a coach?
My father was an All-American sprinter at Virginia State University. He was on. He traveled with the Olympic team that used to travel around the world, I always say he's one of the fastest men in the world. Now he might have been the 10th fastest man in the world or the 20th fastest man in the world, but at one point in his lifetime, he was one of the fastest men in the world, and he worked himself into that position. I think when he got to Virginia State, he'd always tell us he was the last man that they added to the roster. You know, when they started their meets, he was the last guy, and he worked himself to becoming an All-American. So, you know, we learn a lot through our parents, and, you know, he didn't tell us a lot of stories about his success growing up, but he talked about the work. My mother was a special education teacher for 35 years. So my brother and I always say we get our patience from her. You know, she's got an incredible patience for wanting to watch people grow. And watching them achieve and overachieve. You know, when you're a special education teacher, the world looks a little bit different. Achievement and success look a little bit different than what maybe we look at in high performance. And she just would take so much pride in it. You know, both of them were teachers. They both won Teacher of the Year awards a few times, which is pretty neat to kind of experience that and watching them be successful outside of sport. And so that gives us a pretty strong foundation right there with mom and dad, you know, where our dinner conversations were completely different than most. Like we actually, you know, my brother, I was a college basketball coach. He's the GM for the Maine Celtics now.
Let's give him a shout out. Let's give Jarrell a shout out.
Give a shout out to Jarrell.
Yeah, he's going to listen to that.
so he's incredible in his own right and all the things that he does. But we would sit down at the dinner table and we never talked about Jarrell's performances or my performances ever. I was Virginia High School Player of the Year, which is like the equivalent to being Mr. Basketball in the state of Virginia. And we never even had a conversation about it as a family. The only thing we ever talked about was the only thing we ever really had a chance to listen to was mom and dad talking about their students, talking about how they were trying to help people improve and really being sacrificial in everything they had to do. I think that's got my brother and I off to really, really gave us a really good foundation for who we are today.
Sure. I think, and I learned it. I learned it as I went by, as I got older, of how important the parents are in terms of your childhood education, and not just like the ABCs, but the values that are implemented into you, the virtues that you learn along the way. There's so many aspects to parenthood that I don't understand because I don't have children, but I feel on myself where I'm able to, and where I'm at, I wouldn't be at with my parents without having the right ethical compass. I think it's one thing that I think defines a person, and you can sense. I have a really good understanding and a sense of when a person is being intentfully or has a good intent or a bad intent. You know, and those things I think you can through your parents and through how they formed your childhood and the surroundings that I grew up at, that my parents put me in. It just kind of helped me to develop a little sense for the good and the bad. And then also then you behave a certain way as well. And I think like from your hearing that you also were exposed to a lot of information early on that was more socially valuable, and it can shape you as a person along the way. And you could distinguish and be able to make decisions on your own when you were growing up, and then you could distinguish between right and wrong along the way.
Yeah, it was. You know, one thing that's very interesting is, you know, and I always say my dad's like a pro. I mean, he's like a near pro. He's right there. You know, what are guys that are near pros or pros? You talk about Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, like their fathers were pros. So Jameer Nelson, I coached his son, Jameer Nelson Jr. It's like, what are they teaching their kids, you know, that I feel like I share in a commonality with? Number one, they really appreciate and understand the value of practice. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was working with young players, it'd be amazing how many times I'd communicate with their parents and their parents wouldn't understand how important practice was. Mm-hmm. The parents would only be leaning on performance. And I think when you work with the very best and their kids, they talk about practice. They talk about practicing a certain way, practicing with a certain amount of intensity, practicing with a certain amount of intent. You know, when I had Jameer Nelson's son, that's what Jameer, I mean, his dad is unbelievable. I mean, one of the best fathers I've ever interacted with, was incredible with just harping to Jameer Nelson Jr. about the importance of practicing and why you need to practice a certain way. I think that number two, one of the things that the best teach their children is the importance of recovery, not just physically, but mentally after performance, good or bad. You know, really talking about those performances as learning opportunities and getting better at that. Mm-hmm. Because when you're the very best, you recognize that you're not always going to be playing at your best. It's sort of like, what can I be when I'm in my B or C moment? Can I rise to the height of that? And then give myself an opportunity when the moment arises to be the very best. So I think the best teach their children those two things. And if I had to add a third, the best teach their children how important it is to be in that community and how to push that community forward, whether it's off the floor or on the floor, really talking more about, you know, what your persona does inside the group. And so, you know, I think I learned a lot of those things from my father because he was sort of like a celebrity within our community. And so recognizing that people are going to always be watching you. And what does that mean? Well, it's a huge responsibility, but it's a huge gift.
Mm-hmm.
To have that kind of influence with people and amongst people. And so I would always say, like, those are kind of the three things that, you know, when you work with pros and you work with their kids, they're doing a great job of speaking about those things. And I think that's given guys like myself, but also pro NBA pros, their kids in a huge advantage.
Yeah, I think that also with that spotlight kind of thing, it also gives you a sense of how measured you have to be with your words. You know, that a lot of things that you say may or may not be get used against you, but in a sense, like you said, it's a responsibility. So you really have to get the message across the way you really want them to know. You know, like you want them to know what you're thinking and that it's coming from the right place. And when you're speaking out, whether it's in front of the team or it taught you at an early age to how to speak in front of people and how it's going to be interpreted, because the interpretation, I think, I'm very nerdy on communication. I think interpreting and the interpretation of the word and the intent is the key to every communication, to every conversation. Because, you know, like you want to get things across, but sometimes you have to think for the other person of how he's going to perceive that message. So you have to, sometimes you have to know the background, you have to know the cultural ifs, do's and don'ts, you know, so you just kind of have to hit it at the right spot and you have to see if the person is really realizing what you're saying, if he's understanding and knows where you're actually coming from in whatever you call this, not parentheses, quotation marks.
Quotations.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you say that. You know, when we're talking about the transition, that was one of the hardest parts for me. Was, you know, and on my team last year spoke mostly English. I mean, English is either second or third language. But the words that we use in English versus the words that they use in Italian are very different. I'm sort of lean more on softer skills, where this is a very aggressive language.
Yeah.
And so in my 2 years here, I've had to really learn, like, and I'm not there yet. Okay. I'm learning.
Yeah.
What kind of vocabulary to use and what kind of moment that sits with our guys who are the domestic guys here, who are over half our team. And also what that is saying to our fan base. You know, we had like a major thing last year where, you know, as Americans, you know, we do the media and they ask questions and we really don't give you much information, you know, like there's this wall that you kind of keep up with your media members. And that's just not acceptable here in Italy. Okay. You know, so, you know, I had to learn that through the course of the year that it's okay to disagree with the media in front of the media. It's okay to be aggressive with your language and to be the expert in front of the group, you know, where I think in America, they sort of assume you're the expert. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit softer with their questioning and with some of their understanding. Where here, it's like, you got to prove that you're the expert and you've got to really hammer that down. I've got a great communication team that's worked with me to be better at that. But that was a big part of the transition was communication, because I am a communicator. I love communicating. It's really something important to me. And so I'm still learning here how to communicate effectively for our fan base, for our management, and also for our team.
Do you have an example from last year where it's like a typical rookie mistake that you would say some American coaches coming over would do?
Yeah, you know, so all right, we lose the game. okay? And we lose the game, and I would say, hey, you know, I thought we did some good stuff today, and you know, we're gonna work on, we'll get on the film on Monday, and we'll get better at those things, okay? That the speaking with lack of emotion to an Italian fan base makes them think you don't care.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, we're taught as Americans almost to detach from our emotion.
Yeah, like be composed, yeah.
Right, be composed. So I think we went through a large part of last year where the people thought I just didn't care, where there's nothing you care about more. I mean, my family's halfway around the world, and I'm taking an opportunity to try to help promote a team. I'm taking on a tough task. Winning is the only thing I care about. But, you know, I can, you know, once I got a chance to learn the culture a little bit more, you know, I recognize that, like, my passive communication wasn't hitting home, and I needed to be more aggressive. And I could say, you know, they're expecting me to say what the problem is, and it's okay to say what the problem is, and again, be aggressive with that sort of terminology. And you know, I've tried to do a better job of it this year, and again, I'm still learning it, because it's natural for us as Americans to sort of sit back, build that wall up, but you know, here that doesn't fly. So you know, I need to be, you know, we talked about communication is a two-way street. I've got to communicate effectively, not just for myself, but I've got to communicate effectively for our fan base, because the message I'm sending out there is an important message, and I need to make sure it hits home.
Yeah, you got to make sure that they know that you know a lot of times.
Yeah.
Like that's how you got to get it across. And that's the thing that in Europe, in contrast to the States, is where the fans are so passionate and invested that if they see somebody not being with them, it's like there's like a it's going to be, are you with us or are you not with us? You know, like this, that kind of thing. And I remember, I don't want to call out, like there was one coach in that was coaching Lithuania, and he was politically correct in a lot of the press conferences. And the Lithuanian media is so educated in terms of basketball. It's like, come on, man. Like we see what we see, you know, like this be genuine, transparent, and that's, I think, to have to strike that balance of being genuine, knowing that understanding the mistakes that you did, sometimes even admitting to your own mistakes. We all make mistakes, but in regards to being, just being open about your experiences that you made during that game, so that people say, like, okay, this guy is really, like, sincerely, he feels the what was going on, and he's with us, you know, that's empathy, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I would always also remind them, you know, I coached probably 280 games or something in college basketball, right? Now, they don't know what college basketball is. Like, they don't know the level that it kind of falls in, because university here is a different, completely different animal, right? Yeah. So they don't really know kind of where that fits in. Now, I don't know where that fits in on the hierarchy of basketball around the world, but it's a decently high level of basketball. You know, when you're coaching against, you know, I don't know, Tom Izzo, you know, that's a pretty high level of basketball. You
for
know, that's
sure.
Going against, that's pretty good. So, you know, they sort of would look at that, like that experience, what does it matter? Does it matter? And it's like, I would remind them, like, guys, I've coached 280 games as a head coach, all right? Like I have a strong idea of what we need to do and how to get better. And the other guy who might have been coaching, you know, here, second division, he might only have 30 games coaching. It's a huge advantage for me to have 280 games, even though the level, you know, again, we don't know where that level sort of falls, but it's just having that experience of standing on that sideline, calling those timeouts, managing the huddle, managing, you know, all the madness that comes with basketball. And so, again, like kind of learning, like, it's okay to say, hey, I have this much experience. I know exactly what I'm doing, you know, or, hey, I'm still learning this part of the game, you know,
exactly. Like,
you know, here in the top division, we have Croatian coaches, Serbian coaches, Greek coaches. I'm the only American coach still standing. You know, we have coaches from all around the world that have experiences, you know, all over that are amazing coaches. So a big learning lesson for me is to learn, you know, a Serbian style of coaching is one way, a Croatian style of coaching is one way. Like, every one of these countries has a way that they play basketball and a way that they believe basketball should be played. And so a big part of my learning curve is to learn how that countryman sees basketball being played. And without having that experience of knowing that, you know, that is a weakness of mine, that I've got to pick up that somewhere and ask a lot of questions and gain a lot of information, because there's certain tendencies that each one of these countries sort of have with how they believe basketball should be played. And so, again, like, admitting that I'm still learning the coaches, and just being open and honest about that.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think a lot of people, especially in the fan base, they don't understand that out coaching another coach means you have to understand how he's thinking, what the coach is thinking. And like you said, for every country, every nationality or every coaching style and cultural background, there's a different style and they develop their style over time. There's certain guys that are very rigid and they stayed that way the whole time. And a lot of guys, they're fluid. They're adjusting to the roster they have. They're adjusting constantly, but they have some sort of principles they always go by. And you learn that you had to learn on the fly. And it's pretty significant to move up a team from the second division, first division in the first year. I mean, that's a lot of people underestimate that achievement, I think.
Yeah, I think it's happened here in Italy one time in the last 25 years where a team went down and came right back up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we did it in such dramatic fashion. I mean, you know, we went 9-1 in the playoffs, which is, I think, the best win percentage in the history of the playoffs here in Italy. First American coach to ever promote to be the head coach to promote a team. Just a ton of fun things that happened. But, you know, last year was a tough year. I mean, we got off to a great start. Our import got hurt. For people that don't know, in A2 basketball in Italy, you only have two imports last year. Now I think they have three this year. But you have two visas. So these visas are the greatest value maybe in all of sports. You know, they say the quarterback in American sports is the most valuable position. Absolutely not. These two visas are the most valuable position in all of sport history. And one of our imports got hurt in January. And then you have to make a decision, like you can release them and try to add another import with a visa, or you can hold firm. And we made a decision to hold firm, and, you know, he didn't come back until April, you know? So we had to make a game for 3 months without a really valuable piece, a guy who was probably going to be MVP of the year. I mean, Justin Reyes was averaging 20-11 last year when he got hurt. And, you know, we made the decision, and like I told my ownership, I did tell them this. They were like, oh, what do you think we should stay with? So I said, look, we can stay if you want, but it's going to be a cold winter. But I had a great ownership group that stuck with me. And we got everybody else in the group better as we went along and became more versatile. And then when he came back we were just a much better team. And it proved to kind of be the chess piece that put us in that championship series and ultimately, you know, being the best team, one of the best teams in our league.
So the visas are that valuable because of the pricing? Because the league just assigns you two visas for a year and that's it. Like you use them that's it, huh?
You get two visas. Now they get three now, and A1 we get we can have up to eight.
Yeah,
Only play six.
Yeah.
But in A2 last year it was two visas, and there's no exceptions, so you couldn't even really add a third. The only way you could add a visa was if someone was playing in Italy for over a certain number of games and they had already gained the visa base, like kind of earned the visa. So those got players were movable. But again, I mean, how many players are that are movable? You know, it's a very limited market.
Yeah,
it's a very limited market. So, you know, we decided to hold firm and we got an unbelievable team. You know, our team rose to the challenge. But there were some really dark months in there. And like we talked about with European fans, you know, you can lose two games in a row, maybe, but you start to get to 3-4 and that crowd can get a little bit testy. But I tell you what's been great with the promotion is that I really feel like our city and our team is kind of on this wave together now. Mm-hmm. You know, that they didn't feel like it was easy to get back, that we kind of all hung in. Yeah, and we rode the rough sea to get the boat to shore, and now we're kind of all feeling the benefits of it. I mean, I think we're second in our league in attendance this season. I mean, we're basically playing in front of sellouts every single night, and it's because our city, I really feel like they've been a part of this journey to this promotion, and they really feel connected with it.
Yeah, that's the visa part is kind of similar like in Japan. In Japan, they do get a couple more visas, but the thing is that it's hard to get a visa, so the process takes longer. That's why it's hard to cut the player in Japan, unless something just crazy goes down or something that's, you know, very unique to that situation, because it takes a while to bring in another new foreigner. The whole just bureaucracy part of it. That's why I was wondering about the visa part. But when you are aiming to become a coach at a young age and envision yourself as a coach, how much does it differ of what you're envisioning, how you're going to be as a coach, and how you are as a coach now? And I'm still, like, you're still becoming, because JJ Redick said it somewhere, and I don't, at his podcast long time ago, And I don't know if where he has that from, but it's like the saying that you've never arrived, you're always becoming. It's one of my favorite sayings because you are always becoming. You always change. You have to be fluid. You have to absorb information and interpret it and make something out of it and see what lessons you can take from it. But I'm wondering about you, how you envision yourself becoming and what you are now. And obviously, you don't know what you will become in the future, but how big is the difference?
You know, I always say, like, you either coach how you were coached or you coach how you wanted to be coached.
Mm.
You know, and I wanted to be coached in a great environment that allowed everyone to rise to become their best, where there were no distractions on wanting to become your best and the way to become your best. I think leaders build environments, and environments allow people to rise or allows people to fall. And so I've really tried to really focus as a head coach on building the right environment. We talk about trust is like the first foundation. We talk about being all in. We talk about being connected. We talk about being present in the moment, and we talk about competing. And those are like our five values that we have one sign up, you know, Americans love signs. We have one sign up in our locker room area. And that's the only sign. Because I really feel like if we can do those five things, I call those, like, I spent a year out where I was doing some consulting with a lot of different coaches from around the country. And I was taking some classes at the University of Penn. And, you know, so I was like really diving into a bunch of different stuff. And we call those our elite team status. You know, when you reach all five of those levels, you're now an elite team. Mm-hmm. And elite teams outperform about 20% more above what you would maybe guess they would. So that's like our goal. And I wanted to be the head coach that kind of provided that for our team. Like, there's nothing better than coming into an environment where when you make a mistake, there's no emotion connected to the mistake. It's just about how can we fix the mistake. We talk a lot about, you know, like, let's make sure that we can solve the answers inside the room. And I want to make it more about problem solving with the men in the room than about one person having all the answers. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't know how to beat the 2-3 zone. You know, I feel very, very confident I could beat a 2-3 zone. But it's more about like empowering the group to be better than what it has been, you know, mm-hmm. to be aggressively learning what we need to learn to go be at our very best. By keeping everyone engaged in the learning, not necessarily the winning or the losing, but the learning, you know, we're talking about, like, we're always evolving. The learning allows us to evolve. It allows us to evolve faster than I think than most places and coaches that create these kind of environments. And so as a coach, I've always wanted to be that person to create an evolving environment where learning is at the forefront.
Yeah. So take me through that last year a little bit, because coming over and, you know, experiencing that coming to Europe, what did you feel like as the early adjustments with the team? Like, we talked about the culture parts with the journalists, with the fan base, but with your players, the cultural adjustments you had to learn on the fly, basically, of how they want to be coached, you know, in comparison to college players, how they need to be coached. Now you're dealing with pros and coming, you know, as an American coach to Italy, where it's a rarity. Then you have to kind of establish yourself, and I'm not I don't know how much patience there is normally, you know. Yeah. Like, so there has to be a trusting environment first of all, and you create an environment probably from yourself. But what did you feel as a human when you came in? Just kind of like, was there something where you felt like, man, there's a lot of doubters in here, and I have to, like, I want to prove everybody wrong.
Well, there were definitely a lot of doubters. I mean, there were doubters inside our locker room.
Yeah.
You know, but I always say, like, if you're going to be a strong leader, you got to build believers as you go. Mm-hmm. You know, very few leaders started out with everybody following right away. I mean, you've got to build believers with how you interact with them every day, how you interact in bad moments. You know, one of the things I thought was great for our team, actually, was when we lost games, how we responded. And in particular, they would talk about how I would respond, you know, like, we would lose a game or three games or four games, whatever it was. We'd come in, we'd go through our game grades like we normally do, no emotion. We talk about the things we need to get better, no emotion. And then we talk about the plan that we're going to do to get better at those things. They were used to being coached with a lot of emotion and coached really hard, which I don't necessarily think is bad or wrong. That's just not the way that I do it. And it doesn't mean that I don't turn on emotion when I need to turn on emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think people automatically assume that like that I'm like soft, and I don't think anybody who's ever played for me would say that I'm soft. Okay, I don't think that's what you were characterized with me. But I think there's an appropriate time for that.
It's got to be firm. You got to be firm at the right time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, and we're gonna, you know, we're gonna operate a certain way. Like when I put those five values up, we're gonna do those five things,
mm-hmm. And
we're gonna hang on those five things. We're gonna do them at the highest level, and we're gonna learn and get better and learn and improve, mm-hmm. And really just trying to make it about those things. So when we had some really tough moments in the early in the season, I mean, you know, we lost. It was crazy. I mean, we lost like a game in December. We started off like 4-1 or something, and then we lost like two or three in a row. And I mean, they were already chanting for me to be fired. I mean, it was incredible, you know. I mean, I'm telling you, you don't know basketball, and you don't know how badly you want to coach basketball until you got 5,000 fans, your own fans, chanting for you to be fired. Like you don't know, like how badly do you want to do it? You know, yeah. How badly do you want to prove that you can achieve this task, right? But you know, it was incredible. My point guard, Michele Ruzier. We're playing at Piacenza, and our one of our imports is away on away, and we win this incredible game. You know, Ariel Folloy hits a bunch of threes, scores 26 points, whatever. And after the game, Michele, it was a tough moment. It was when it first started being a tough moment. He goes, "I'm really happy for you," you know, and that's when I knew we were sort of, you know, like. Because I stayed pretty firm, you know, no matter how people treated me or operated to me, I didn't really waver. I didn't come in a locker room and waver. I mean, I stayed the same. You know, one thing someone asked me a long time ago in an interview, they said, "What's one thing that people don't know about you?" And I said, I'm a much tougher guy than you think.
Mm-hmm.
And in that moment, I need to lean on that. But also in that moment, I needed to lean on those guys some.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those tough moments, because we responded the same way as a coaching staff, and we just kept working on getting better, and we kept being positive and improving, you can be positive and still get better at the things you didn't do well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's this connotation that, you know, this overall positivity means you don't adjust. And no, we were adjusting and getting better and working on those things. And I would say we were working on those things fearlessly to get better. And so I think we built a good level of trust because we went through, you know, four or five games in a row we lost and getting completely booed and stuff thrown at us. And you go through, you know, the European experience, you go through that. But we all stood tall. We all stood firm. We all stood together. I think we'll always have lifelong bonds because we went through that. And ultimately, it made us so much tougher as a group because any kind of outside negativity, that just pushed us all to the middle.
Yeah.
You know, we really walked out and felt like, oh, this is just the 10 of us. This is just 11 of us.
Yeah.
And I think that really pushed us together as a team. And ultimately, it was one of the biggest reasons why we had success because we had no other choice. You know, we couldn't look left or right because we had no one that supported us on the left or the right. We had to look at one another. I remember there was this incredible moment in the toughest part of the season. We had this picture taken. We have media people taking pictures all the time. And took this picture of practice from overhead. And, you know, we were locked arms, but we were decently far apart. In the toughest moment of the season, they took the same picture and we were just locked arms naturally. You know, when body languages start mirroring each other,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our energies are synchronizing together, that's when a team really moves. And so I took the picture from the beginning of the year. I put it on the film session from the beginning of the year to where we were near the end of the year. And everybody had basically taken two more steps forward. Everyone was really all in. And I told that this is when I knew we were going to be all right. Because we could have all taken a step back. And we didn't naturally do that. We all took a step forward. And I think it's those kind of little things that as a leader, you got to acknowledge those improvements in tough moments.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're able to do that, you can keep building on those tougher moments and really come out ultimately being as successful as a group can become.
I think exactly that is the most rewarding part of coaching. You know, it's like the winning is just like the end. Like the winning the championship, obviously, like that's like everybody is just, there's a whole bunch of things going on there. There's the build up towards that. And when you see the bond happening, you feel it. You know, you feel that some things are changing within the team and your team is coming closer together. And it feels like nobody can beat you. You know, like you go out there with a completely different demeanor because it's a unified, it's a union, you know, and Those things, I think, I remember also when you're in the locker room or in the, you see like those guys are just out there for each other, and it's nothing that's going to destroy them. Even when they lose, they still win in a way because it brings them even closer together.
Yeah, and that's what, like, I mean, you're exactly right. That's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah.
Is like, can we as coaches do the things that we need to do and say the things that we need to say and create the environment in a way that needs to be created to push the team closer together so they can go accomplish great things? Because any team, just about any team, can achieve some level of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
But if all parts are not working together, it'll never get there. And the majority of the teams that you play against, they just don't have the capability to get there. You know, I would say, like, do you have the capacity to reach your full capacity? And I think when you're adding people to your team, you know, does this person have that? Because that's a connective energy. You know, when I get one guy who's a capacity and another guy asks, you know, now everyone starts to have that capacity and the team can fly almost on its own.
I want to write that down.
People like that, you know, I think it's really important.
Like, yeah, you said that that's a, do you have the capacity to reach your full capacity? That's a great quote. That's something that, because that's a next level thinking of, in terms of, you know, you have to have the capacity, but then there's an extra capacity that you have to get to in order to reach your potential. And I think that you have to really think back a lot of times, be able to reflect on your own actions, be able to reflect on practices and analyze things. And then as you learn, because some guys are natural talented, so they have like a never-ending capacity. You know, some guys, if they combine the learning process with the capacity that they have, it's just going to expand. You just got to be willing to do it, you know, like being able to go through the grind.
It's, you know, you're in scouting, so you recognize this. I think, you know, we at one point in Mount St. Mary's, which is low major Division I, and then Siena, we had 18 out of 23 guys play professionally overseas. Right? Like an incredible, like it just doesn't happen, right? And then we got to GW and we kind of had a bunch of guys. Now we have like Jamison Battle, who's playing in the NBA, and I coach Jalen Pickett at Siena, but we had a bunch of these guys. And none of these guys were like highly rated players or none of these guys, you know, Jalen Pickett, when we took him, someone told us he was a Division III player. We took him, moved him to the point guard spot. And, you know, there's a week he beats Zion Williamson out for freshman of the year of the week. You know? But I always felt like with a guy like Jalen Pickett or Jamison Battle or even Jameer Nelson Jr., I felt like they had the capacity to reach their full capacity because mm-hmm. they were so hungry.
Mm-hmm.
I was so hungry to learn. You know, you would sit down with, like, I remember sitting down with Jalen Pickett, and I had just gotten to Siena, and he was an available player from Rochester, and people were kind of playing him at the two and the three, but he's a guy who, like, he played football. They won football, and they were state champions in football or something crazy. They played basketball. They're, like, the best basketball team. He played City Rocks, you know, and he's a guy that you could put on the floor with all these really good players, and they, like, win with City Rocks. And I remember just, you know, sitting down with him and I was like, you know, he's like 6'4", his body's built kind of boxy, you know? And I remember I did this thing with the recruits where I write a play on the board with terminology. And the first play is fairly simple, you know, and then I erase it. Say, all right, you draw it back for me, you know, and he has to give me the terminology. And then I did the second play and the third play. And Jalen Pickett's the only guy that I've had that got to the third play. And not only did he memorize the terminology, but he asked me a question. And I said, this guy has something, like he's fucking really smart. Excuse my language.
Yeah.
Because no one ever asked the question. Everyone is so caught up in the terminology. And the final term could be like, hook one down X, like, you know, it's like a lot. It's like six or seven things that you're putting together, you know, hook one down X, hammer, cross. You know, something you may never do in a game. And he got to the end and said, well, if they do this, should we do this or should we do this? You know, and like,
yeah.
And like, he just was like quick, you know, with it. And that's when I said, we're taking this guy. I don't know what position he is, but his ability to process information in real time when you talked about basketball, his eyes are moving like this. Like he's visualizing the spots on the floor and you can see that he's, you know, he's engaged with it mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, like you know, having the capacity to reach a full capacity. You know, I didn't necessarily know he'd get drafted by the Nuggets, but I did feel like he'd become the very best he could become.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's all you can really ask people to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what you're aiming for, right? Like, just be the best version of yourself every day, and try to become the best version of yourself, whatever you can become. Like, just aim for the highest parts of yourself, and make sure that you maximizing. Without, I think there's also a difference between are you pushing yourself too much, or is it easily like pulling you towards it? You know, like that, if you pull and you just kind of, you naturally want to grow, you have to be interested in it. If you're not really passionate and engaged, then you're not gonna be fully, you know, you're not gonna grow to that capacity. If you're engaged naturally and you're obsessed with it, you're gonna go through the roof. And like you just, that's this is the only way.
Yeah, it's when you're really, it's amazing how the world magnetizes things for you when you're working in a genuine way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of the things that you're always wanted come to you way, way more easily when you're not getting in your own way. You know, when you're able to just let the world bring to you what it will, and you just said, I'm just going to bring my effort. And I'm going to bring my mindset, and I'm going to bring my kindness and my being genuine towards it. I think people really often struggle with that, especially in America. We're a capitalism society. So we're like, get in what you can. When you have leverage on something, you leverage a situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I will say that's an interesting dynamic being in Europe, coming from, you know, a really heavy capitalistic society. We'll talk about that later, I'm sure. But I think that ability to allow the world to bring you what is meant for you.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to fight for it and chase it, but I'm going to fight for myself to be the very best I can be.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever it falls for me, my opportunity, I'm ready to go and attack it with everything that I have.
That's exactly like and I can judge it only by my experience, because I prepared myself for what was coming without knowing what was coming. But whenever it arrives at that situation, and I'm not talking about playing, because playing was deterred by injuries and things happened the way they happened. But now I'm probably in a better situation than I may have been as a player. But in regards to preparing yourself, going through the process and doing things without cutting corners and doing things the right way, and then once the situation presents itself to you, you're naturally ready for it, even though you still have to learn a lot, but you have the capacity and you want to learn, then you're not actually going to absorb all the information that's thrown at you, but you already have a foundation. You already know what it takes to go through the grinder. I hate to admit it, but my college coach got me ready for some of the worst situations. My college coach and me, I had a year of eligibility because of my redshirt year. And I finished my degree in college, and I was like, I'm signing a contract in Europe. I'm out. I'm sorry, I'm out. Like and there are some things that I was looking back at, like the guys I was going to war with every day. They made it to the Division II Elite Eight. I was like, oh man, like that's something that I wish I could have had it with them, you know. But on the other hand, like I could not bear it. And he prepared me for some of the things that, you know, just the mental grind, just to fight through those situations and be gritty. I had some of that when I came to the US, and those things helped me like just naturally to be just competitive. You always want to prove yourself, and you get it tried all the time. And I think the more you go through those trials and tribulations, the more you're ready for when they come again. If you give in, you're going to continue to give in. And I think that's once you start fighting through it, you're going to continue to fight through it, because you know what, you just don't want to be on that losing end.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, can you have endurance for the battle?
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. Battle is not just the battle without, but it's the battle within.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I follow this guy, David Goggins, who's like this, like marathoner, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with him. And it's like, you know, that ultra marathon idea is like, that's the game of life, is can I be the best at the ultra marathon of the game of life? And not worry about the 5 miler, but do the best I can at 5 miles, and do the best I can at 6 miles, and do the best I can at 7 miles, and sort of stack these opportunities in front of me so that I have endurance, you know, for the battle. You know, I was consulting with some coaches the year I was out. So I had probably 19 to 20 coaches I was working with. And I would always try to help them have endurance for the battle. Like, coach, it's November 17th. You know, you've got 25 games left. You know, have endurance for the battle, have endurance for the fight that's ahead, and and prepare your team for that. Because there is a final date to this season. And if you lose the, if you lose too many battles too early, I'm not talking about games, talking about the spirit of your warriors. You know, we have a tremendous responsibility that we got to win the battle of the spirit every single day. And if you can win the battle of spirit every single day, and at some point that spirit takes off and it gives you wings. But if you keep clipping the spirit, then you don't have any wings when you need them. And it sounds like your college coach is preparing you all for the endurance of the battle. And sometimes as players, we get a little bit lost because we want it all right now. And it's coming for us. We just got to stay with it.
Yeah, I mean, there was some other dirty stuff that I want to get into. But I'm going to share my screen with you because I want to give out. Do you know ProBallers.com?
I do know it.
Yeah, they're a sponsor of this podcast. So I'm going to do you see my screen?
Absolutely.
All right. So I'm going to go in and type in your team. And the thing is, the last game, I would just wanted to give a short or short analysis of box score. What you're looking at, what you're looking at as a coach after the game when you look at the stats, and you guys beat Treviso. So what's the thing that you follow? That like the first three things that you look at when you're analyzing the game, like right after the heat of the battle.
All right. So the first thing I'm looking at is our rebounds. And I used to, like, what's interesting, I used to be a non-rebounder. I used to be a, not, like, we used to send everybody back after every shot went up. I didn't care about rebounding at all. We were going to shoot 50% of our shots from three. We're going to win that kind of game. And then my year out, I just discovered like a couple other tactics and I was like, we have to rebound the ball. And I just love the physicality of it. So, you know, we out rebounded them 43 to 36. So number one, that level of physicality for me is very important. You know, we got, I think we had 11 offensive rebounds. Like they had 10, you know, something about our team, we get 36% of our misses back. I thought we could be the first team in the history of the world to get 40% of our misses back and to shoot 40% from three. Okay. We were right there, but I don't know if we're going to get there. We've been right there all season because we're shooting such a high percentage from three. But if you can shoot 40% from three and get 40% of your misses back, again, I thought we'd be the first team in the history of the world to go 40 for 40. So I'm looking at the rebounds, number one. Number two, I'm looking at our assists. The quality of our assists really generate the quality of our shooting opportunities. You know, we talk a lot about paint touches being the most important thing for us offensively and limiting their paint touches. So I'm looking at those two things first and foremost. I actually never look at the points. I look at the rebounds and the assists. The rebounds speak to our physicality. The assists speak to the way that we move the ball. And then I usually start looking at the plus minus, you know, to see who was really effective for us and who was not effective for them.
Really? Try to convince me why the plus minus is I'm not completely bought into that.
There's some people who are not bought into it. My high school coach was doing plus minus for us in high school. So I grew up with this idea of there's certain lineups and rotations that sort of work well. I will say this, I'm a big data guy, but I don't believe data should make the decision for you. Which I think some people want to just kind of push the decision-making off to the data. For me, it's like, all right, we're plus minus with Markel Brown on the floor. He obviously was 14. You know, we actually played this game with only one real point guard. So Markel had to play some point guard for us. He is not a point guard. He usually plays like an off-ball scorer, but because of our rotations in this game, he had to play some. So what I'll do with that plus 14 is I'll go back and look at what he was when he was at the point guard spot to see if did we get a plus six or whatever that was, because that's going to be curious for us if we have injuries down the road. And see, hey, can we maybe play with that lineup a little bit with certain people on the floor? But for me, plus minus is very big over a season in particular. I think there's also things you'll see. There'll be certain guys that play better versus certain types of teams. So if you have we would kind of break them up into 10 kind of teams. You have like a power team that has two forwards. Two centers, you know, they play really physical. So maybe like the Portland Trailblazers, right? There'll be certain guys that play better against that. So if we can get enough kind of teams and games in that area, we could say, all right, in this rotation, we need to play this guy a little bit more. He's had a lot of success versus this. If it's a team that plays four guards, well, maybe our big guys struggled more. I mean, it kind of makes sense, but sometimes the big plays better against the smalls because you get the offensive rebounds. So what I say is just get all the data and kind of put the teams in these kind of categories, these boxes, and that allows us to kind of put the lineups where we need to. And then additionally, when we talk about the lineup data, you know, the plus minus is pretty, gives you pretty good indication in the lineup data at the end of this, which is not on this box score, but I'm always kind of just watching that to see like, you know, so those are three things that I go to first.
Yeah, it's like the plus minus kind of, I use it to confirm or disconfirm my feel for a situation that a player, you know, maybe he was good in that particular lineup against this particular lineup, you know, and then there's some, you got to feel that he was contributing in a major way or just really was a big minus. I think that minus stands out more than the plus, because if you're winning, everybody looks good kind of thing, you know, like there's
like if you look at Cam Ducey for us. One of my favorite players of all time. Candusi's a 6'11 stretch five.
Yeah.
You know, 5 points plus 10 in the plus minus, you know, 10 minutes played. Sometimes it tells us we're playing a guy the perfect amount of times versus the perfect lineups. So sometimes with him, we'll say, if you sub in this guy, he's going to play. So we're looking for that. So that tells us we were right about that decision.
Uh-huh.
Because we got maximum minutes from him and maximum output for him. Also, I think with the plus minus, you can start to notice if I'm playing a guy too many minutes, when there's diminishing returns, on maybe a little bit of fatigue or something like that. But again, I think all the data for me, the analytical data for me, again, I've grown up with this as you have. I'm not letting it make a decision for me, but I am looking at it as a part of the decision. And you know, just like if you have a guy who's always negative in the plus minus, you know, no matter what lineup you try, you know, you start with different lineups or playing different guys, then, you know, maybe he just is not a good system fit for what you're trying to do. And that also gives you that kind of information. But I know people are hot and cold on plus minus, but it's been a pretty good indicator for me, just, you know, in my lifetime.
Yeah, that's a good one. So
Did I convince you on the plus minus, or you're still?
I mean, like that part with Candusi was interesting because that the particular thing that you prepare for, particularly for this team and in this against a certain matchup, that I can see that you want to confirm your decision, you know, and you kind of look back at something that you want to base your decision on. That's one thing. I'm sure that's a good one. About coaching going on. There's something, this Ali Abdaal YouTube course. Have you heard of Ali Abdaal?
Hmm.
I've heard of him through Chris Williamson, who's my favorite podcaster, Modern Wisdom. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Modern Wisdom. I listen to him every day. So he had Ali Abdaal on his show a couple of times, and he was talking about the importance of teaching people who are three steps behind of where you are, because when you are 10 steps ahead, it's sometimes difficult to remember what challenges that people who are 10 steps ahead behind you deal with. Do you remember your first difficulties that you had to go through when you started off coaching?
I mean, I think every level provides you with a different level of difficulty. You know, I remember, and there've been a lot of difficulties kind of working through that. I've had really good teachers along the way when I was three steps behind that taught me. You know, I think I'm thinking back to like my first job at Emory and Henry College, Division III. I played Division I basketball. I didn't really understand Division III. I was kind of learning it. And I think one of the first challenges was, you know, I was a player who played above the level where I was coaching, but they had this great respect for how I played, and I had to figure out how to communicate for them to rise, you know, to that, you know, to the things that we were doing, the way that we were thinking at that level. That was, you know, it's funny. I mean, I would say it was challenging, but that was kind of the fun part.
Yeah.
You know, like it was like, man, like I'm going to help you, you know, and they're like, oh, Division I, you guys do this. And it's like, all right, well, yeah, and this is how we do it. And this is how hard we work. And, you know, it's not just that we're on scholarship and we just pray about, you know, we play basketball two times a week. We play every day. We lift every day. And this is the mindset that it takes. And, you know, helping helping someone who wants to aspire to get to that level learn the work ethic that it takes to get there. You know, so I'll say that was definitely one of them. Another one was when I was at VCU, my first day on the job, Shaka Smart calls me into his office and he says, I need you to do two things for us, Jay. He says, Jay, I need you to do two things for us. And I'm, you know, coach, whatever, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm like on the tip of my toes. He goes, number one, you need to make Troy Daniels a pro. All right. All right, coach, whatever we got to do. Number two, we got to score in Richmond because I was overseeing the offense. All right, I could do that. And so I took the first mission was Troy, and Troy had made, you know, 18 threes in his career at that time as a rising junior. And I'm like, I don't know how to make a guy pro. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't a pro. I hadn't coached any pros at that point. But you kind of just go into it with an enthusiasm, and a hunger that is a little bit different and a willingness to do whatever it takes. And, you know, Troy was a pretty hard worker. You know, what Troy Daniels is an incredible person who wants to get the most out of himself. And like many of us at the time, maybe didn't know the layers that he could go to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was just there saying, man, you know, I was just saying to him, hey, man, I'm at the gym, man, whenever you want to go, you know, whenever you want to be here, man, we'll make 250, you know, we'll do whatever. And, you know, I thank God every day for him because, you know, he allowed me to coach him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't have to allow me to do that. You know, and we worked now. I mean, we worked and he was there and he was happy to do it. And I wouldn't say he was always happy to do it. But he was there and he was eager and he was focused. And, you know, that's a challenge when you have a lofty goal, you know, of a guy becoming, you know, one of the 400, you know, yeah, the 450, whatever the number is, right? And then to watch him work himself into becoming that sort of player, he always had it inside of him. You know what I mean? I think he always had it inside of him. But it's just about sometimes you need someone there right with you and encouraging you and showing you the way. And, you know, it's a joy to watch a guy like that be able to get to the NBA.
Yeah. Yeah, those lessons along the way, I think at that moment, you may not realize everything that you're learning and processing. And then afterwards, like, oh, man, those little nuances here and there that kind of shape me, you know, in a certain way. Because when other situations arise, you already have something already to come back to. You know, if you don't go through the process, if you don't go through certain adversity and certain difficulties, whether it's, you know, coaching a guy that, you know, needs to become a pro and you never done it before, but then along the way you pick up things that you can use here and there, tidbits of it that were just kind of, you know, helpful in the process.
What's, yeah, and with him it was like, I mean, he was always this incredible shooter. You know, it's just more about like the mental side of it, of like, how do you handle misses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's you know, like, you know, you miss one, so now you miss two because you miss one because you're still hanging on to the one. And it's like, mentally, how can we get off of the miss? You know, so we tried like a disassociation tactic, where every time he would miss, I'd say, what is the thing that made you the happiest and, you know, makes you smile when you think about it? And he would say Beyonce at the time. You know, he's married now, so maybe he probably doesn't want me to say it, but okay, right? And so I said, every time you miss, you have to say Beyonce, you know, just to disassociate with the miss into something that makes you happy, that makes, yeah, you something you appreciate, yeah, whatever it is. It can be anything, people listening. It doesn't have to be the greatest pop star of all time.
No, it's going to be Beyonce for me too now.
But, you know, I think just having that kind of mental practice of disassociation from that at that time. Now, I think that worked at that time. Then you graduate to another level, you kind of find something else and whatever. But, you know, it was just the first time to try to just give him something where he wasn't hanging on to the misses and you know, learning how to learn from the misses and not regret it.
So let me ask you this, because coaches go through the same thing in a different way. How do you eliminate negative self-talk, whether it's during a game, after the game? Like, how do you not decompress after the game? That's probably a different avenue to go to, but negative self-talk, like, oh, I should have done this, I should have done this. You know, like, you have to move on quickly. How do you disassociate yourself from the bad decision
making? That's an incredible question, because that's the journey of self. Really, I mean, I spend all week trying to pump myself up with the right information so that in the key moment, I'm not having those kind of thoughts.
Mm.
I would say I've worked like my lifetime to try to put myself in the right position to keep thinking the right way. I'm a big meditator. I do a ton of meditation before the game. I meditate through the week. I write journals, affirmations. I just think there's so many things that you need to do to make sure that your brain is in the right position to go be what you need it to be. And recognizing that your brain is a muscle that just wants to protect you from any kind of hurt and pain. And that you've got to trick your brain to believe what you believe. And you've got to really, you know, you've got to hammer yourself with that. You know, I use a couple techniques. Number one, like you see in the game, snapping. You know, I try to snap myself out of any kind of negative thought. Every now and then, you know, I talk about visualizing a reset button on my hand and literally pressing the reset button, you know, and just trying to, you know, before the game, I always ask God for three things. I ask him to allow me to be what these men need me to be, to say what needs to be said, and to do what needs to be done. So during the game, I'm trying to stay in a moment of service to the men, to those who are out there performing their blood and sweating out there, giving everything they have. I feel like when I get into my own self-doubt, I'm thinking about myself. And so if I'm serving the men, then it's really hard to think about myself and making that mistake. If I make a mistake, snap myself out of it. I gotta go. It's not even about making up for it. Right. It's not even about making up for it. I just need to stack good decisions together along the way. But it's a good question because, you know, I think not enough people think about that. They don't think about. And I think when people slide over that chair, this is what they struggle the most with. It's not about, you know, whether or not we should go four low underneath out of bounds or run hook one in the half court. People think it's all that. It's literally like, and I've learned this because when I was at GW, I was in a horrible mental space. We were in COVID. We had tanks on campus. It was a shortened season. You know, there's all this pressure to win and all these factors were dealing with all these things against winning and getting put you in a position to do that. So I was in just such a horrible place. You know, up until that point in my career, I'd been unbelievable with my self-talk and my discipline. And then I got there and the world sort of changed.
Well, you're in the epicenter of every, like awful. That was like.
It was awful. And it just kind of flipped me. You know, and I couldn't really get back into rhythm until it was too late. And so I spent that, one of the things I did that year I was off and I was doing all the learning and doing all this stuff was like, I said, if I go back and do this, right? Number one, if I go back and do this, I'm going to do this better than I've ever done it. I'm going to do it the way that I want to do it. And I'm going to find happiness in the battle. Yep. I'm going to find joy in the battle. Yep. And you can't find joy if you're fighting yourself. And then those 2 or 3 years I was at GW, I was fighting myself the whole time, trying to prove this or that or whatever. You know, I'll say that. I said, I've coached to want to earn more. I've coached to want to prove myself. I've coached to want to stay alive. And now I'm coaching because I want to coach.
Yeah.
And there's nothing better than that because there's nothing that can happen outside the floor or whatever that's going to move me off. I'm coaching because I want to coach. And if I didn't want to coach, I wouldn't be in Italy coaching, you know, across the ocean from where I'm comfortable. But having the, you know, the tenacity to say, hey, I'm going to go and do that. And I'm going to go give myself an opportunity to go and do that has really put me in the right place. And I've had to, and I'm telling you, you got to work on it every day. You got to tell yourself where you want to go, how you're going to get there. And you cannot let your self-talk control you in a negative way. And I think it's something that's really underestimated and underappreciated.
That's what Jocko Willing was. Have you seen this clip? Good. Yeah. That's one of my favorites. He's just like, oh, mission got aborted. Good. Let's plan another one. Let's make it better. Like, you know, everything that gets thrown at you, you just kind of like just twist it into a positive light and just like, we're going to work through this. And I've gotten to a point where it's now I'm organizing this, this summit in Lithuania in July. BHSummit.com if you guys want to just kind of, I'm sneaking it in here. But I wasn't planning on it actually, but that's something that I've encountered some adversity along the way. And I'm like, good. Yeah, that's awesome. Great. Let's do this. And then we're going to do this instead. We're going to do this with this person. Some things come along the way and just kind of, I think 10 years ago, I would have been very nervous. I would have been, you know, that's, I think, maturation process you have to go through to see it through a different light. You know, like to see with the different lenses, because certain things is just like, this is not the end of the world. This is just like, this is just another thing that we have to deal with. And if it's not that, it's going to be another thing. So let's do something that's going to be worthwhile doing, and it's going to be hard, and it's supposed to be hard, because anybody could do it if it wasn't going to be hard. So I'm embracing it, and this is fun, and I want it to be hard actually for it to be rewarding at the end. It shouldn't be losing my hair or you know like whatever. But in regards to like, I want it to be hard and I want it to be challenging because that's something that's going to make me grow along the ways. And I'm going to be coming out on the other side as a different person, different professional, different, just stronger and better at so many things. So those things, I think, like, people have to understand. It's good. I think challenges are good. And in what way they come, it's everybody's lifestyle determines that.
Yeah, when they were, you know, last year when, you know, they had a protest for me to be fired last year where they didn't even come to the first half of the game. And look, they came in, we're up by 20 at the half when they come in. So, you know, so we had all these incredible things happen last year. And, you know, we had protests and firings and, you know, people were going, you know, this, the passion of it, you know, which I love. And I just remember telling myself when they were booing, walking off the floor, I've never said this to anybody. So maybe my wife knows this. I said, I'm going to make all these motherfuckers stand and chant my name. You know, and I was like, I can't wait to do that. And then when they did that, I didn't even care. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, you know, they say your name before the game and they were just like, boo me. And I would say, I'm going to clap for my damn self. You know what I mean? I'm gonna clap for my damn self. And I was just like, so into it. And then, you know, and so like, then when they were, you know, we won it and it was like a completely different feel, you know, the joy was in completing the task. You know, it wasn't even in any kind of retribution for, you know, the things that were said before and how things operated. And actually for me, there was like a huge level of just like forgiveness, you know, had people coming up to me and saying, we're so sorry. I mean, and we've got an incredible relationship with our fans, like, you know what I mean? But just the level of forgiveness I had for that and the level of grace I had for it, because I didn't do it for that.
Yeah.
You know, I did it for the challenge of the task. And I did it for those guys in that locker room. And
exactly.
And I'm really grateful actually for the adversity. Like you were saying, like I'm grateful for that. Like I felt like, man, like I had to really have tough skin to do that and to show that. And I think it makes for an incredible story.
Yeah, exactly. Like at the end of the day, we're all human beings. We all have like certain things that we have to go through. We get emotional and certain other things. And I can understand other people getting emotional at me. And I'm just like, okay, all right, we're going to do this now and then we're going to move on. And then tomorrow we're going to worry about different things. So let's get it over with and let's move on. Cause there's so many worse things in life that we don't have to deal with. So let's be realistic. So your answer to can you be achieving without being self-abusing is yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think I will say this. The very best know how to tap into different parts of their emotion in different moments.
Mm-hmm.
But the very best also know when to step out of that box.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so there might be a moment where you can be self-abusing. Let's go. You got to get this, whatever you say to yourself. But you don't stay in that moment. You know, it's really learning what do I need to be at my very best right now? And how can I recalibrate my system to get mm-hmm. it right where I need to be at for optimal performance? But I would say that being painful to yourself for too long and for too often is completely detrimental to what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing, in my opinion, is achieved without a high level of joy. And that joy for whatever you're asking, whatever you're trying to do is rarely ever achieved through negativity. I mean, it's like if you're putting bad gas in your gas tank, but you're expecting your car to go fast. It just doesn't work that way. Yeah. You got to put the very best gas in your gas tank for the car to go fast and for it to run smoothly. So I definitely lean more on that positivity to yourself and kindness to yourself.
Okay, I got one observation for you from Chris Williamson's podcast. He was reading it out, and I'm just like not I'm quoting him, reading it to Alex Hormozi in the podcast. So I'm generally being transparent here. This is not mine, but I want to see what you say to this because you can correlate it to sports. That's why I kind of picked it. Heroes and villains all have the same backstory, pain.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is what they choose to do about it. Villain says, the world hurt me, I'll hurt it back. The hero says, the world hurt me, I'm not going to let it hurt anybody else. Heroes use pain. Villains are used by it. What's your analysis to that?
You know, I use this. I use the heroes and villains a lot with our team. I use it a lot because I think the foundation of your emotion for your task is important to understand. Because whichever, you know, if you're a villain, that pain means you hurt other people. When you're a player and you're hurting yourself, you're putting that bad gas in, that's how you're going to respond to others. And that's how you respond to yourself in really tough moments. So I talk a lot about heroes and villains and, like, you know, why I think the environment that we're creating is so important in a positive way and in a, you know, how we talk to each other, how we work with each other is so that when those big moments arise, we rally together. Mm-hmm. That we don't point the finger, that we look at one another in a certain way. So I actually talk a lot about heroes and villains. I actually use a lot of characters like Superman or Batman with players for individual conversation and performance, mm-hmm. right? Because I think that's important to, you know, if you look at Superman, who has very few weaknesses or whatever it is. So I kind of add that in there. I love using those characters. I think they are essential to help people and players understand where they're trying to get to and to understand that what you put in yourself is what you're going to get out of it mentally as well. I missed a question because I just love the analogy, but give it to me one more time.
It's not a question, but it's just more like the analysis of the sentence that pain is being used in different ways. But it's just that because it's a you know, what we talked about before, you know, the self negative self-talk, and it's just the pain that the villains and the heroes use in a different way. And, you know, villains are used by it and heroes use pain in a different way. So what do you think about this little analogy here?
I think in basketball, we're going to come across a lot of players who are going to get to our level who have been using it as villains. I think for them to become the best versions they can be, they have to become heroes with how they use it. Mm-hmm. You're gonna come with a guy who's been from a very maybe impoverished background, a trauma-filled background. He's now become a great player because he's tried to get away from that pain and from that trauma. That pain is still there. That pain is still empowering them. Mm-hmm. Pain is all around them. At some point in their career, that pain will start to push them downward. It'll sort of become overwhelming. For them to be their best, we've got to be able to take what they've learned there and flip that into a hero, into becoming a hero so that they can help other people. Mm-hmm. I think that's for a basketball player, for a lot of basketball players, that's the character arc. Is you've been a great villain to yourself and now you need to become a great hero to yourself in order to get to that next level. That's what I've seen interacting with a lot of young people through basketball.
Yeah. No, that's cool. That's very cool. You ready for my ATOs? I throw them at the end of the podcast just to kind of, before we go into it, why did you just stop your podcast?
I should have kept doing it. I'm disappointed that I stopped doing it. I think we got up to 60 episodes. It was really, we're top 10 on Spotify for the year.
We're
killing it. The company I was working with, we kind of split up. And I didn't really have, like, I didn't have a co-host. You know, there's some things that, I mean, you do this now often. It's like, I wish I had a producer because a producer helps you kind of get guests. And you know, this thing is all powered by really quality guests. Yeah. And so, you know, I was kind of leaning on my good friends and we're bringing in guests and doing that. And we had an editor and we kind of had all this stuff building company. And then we kind of just kind of broke up and guys kind of started doing other things. Every day I wake up, I think I want to do it again. You know, I think, I wish I had a co-host to do it with. And, you know, I've watched, now everyone does a podcast. I was doing it 4 years ago or 3 years ago. I was kind of on the front end of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, maybe I'll come back. You know, I really enjoy doing it. I love being on your side of it where, you know, I'm asking questions and bringing in really, really interesting people and finding out, you know, their story and helping them share it with people. And I really, really enjoy that.
Yeah, it's I didn't there was some certain things that happened through this podcast that I didn't expect to happen, and it was like it was a unexpected network effect that I experienced on my travels with my job that opened up avenues into different people that I didn't expect. And then you get random messages, or you random people come up to you and it's like, oh, man, that episode was really good. I really enjoyed it. And no incentives or anything like that. It's just kind of, you can see it's genuine and sincere connection. So that really, I think the podcast, besides learning and besides sharing opinions and sharing thoughts, sharing my experiences to people and with my guests to make other professionals better, I think that's very rewarding. And the other part is also like just like the side effect of it that I didn't expect of it. But yeah, like the people that get to talk to, there's a lot of professionals that listen to this, and I think that it's very helpful that you share your backstory. I think there's so many nuances that people need to understand of multicultural coaching. That's such a challenge that a lot of people can go through. Some Europeans that go to the US, they probably experience the same thing, and vice versa. Like there's so many things cross culture that are happening. And now I was recently in Japan also I usually get a guide when I go to cities, and I just spend a couple hours with a local guide one-on-one, and I just drill him with questions about culture, about communication, about how to get to people to this in this country. Japan is just such a unique, and that's a whole different podcast. But those things, I think, especially in cultures like that are far east or completely different than what you're used to, that's when you learn to communicate in a different way, and you learn to grow as you're dancing a tango together, and you're trying to figure out which way to turn and how to do it. So I think this is the fun part of the podcast. You know, you're learning along the way, and you're figuring things out, and then you can add on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, the number of things that I took from my podcast, I mean, we had Daniel Pink on, you know, he wrote a book called The Power of Regret. And he does, you know, when they write these research books, they're researching it for X number of years and they have all this data. And so, you know, one of the things we had last month was no regrets. And I can use like some of the data and stuff that we had with them and, you know, just what that feels like, you know, feeling like you left something, you know, you regret a lot of times the things that you didn't go for. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, let's not have any regrets, man. Let's just leave it all out there and see what happens. We'll walk out of this. And so we had talked about that, you know, we had Ethan Cross on, who right now is like one of the hottest selling books in the country. He's like a good friend of mine now. But, you know, you just have these kind of like people on, like you said, you can really get connected with, and you can ask them whatever, you know, have their full attention for 45 minutes or an hour and 15.
Yeah.
And any question you've ever wanted to ask them, they give you the most genuine answer. And you know, that stuff is really cool, man. And I appreciate what you get to do. And I'm jealous. I wish I had the chance to do it more. I would still do it. You know, but the workload of it, you know what I mean? It can really be tough if you don't have like a producer and an editor and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I have some people in the background that are helping me, like this guy doing the video, like putting it together. I'm uploading it. I mean, it's like, I'm glad the sales let me do it. I'm very fortunate of having the flexibility and the autonomy to do this kind of thing. And they know I'm going to be responsible with what I say. Like I it's not like I'm going wild here. So ATOs, what's your favorite follow social media?
That's a tough one.
David Goggins, we have one.
Yeah, I don't follow him. I don't follow David Goggins on social media. Okay. So I do this thing. This isn't a great answer. Okay. I do this thing where I try to clear my algorithm every month.
Wow. Okay.
So I kind of dive into different things each month.
Wow. That's cool. That's a cool answer.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, it's a guy named Shalom Bloom, maybe S-A-H-I-L-B-L-O-M. I've been following a lot of his stuff recently. He does some kind of creative graphics with different stuff. You know, so I've just seen a bunch of his stuff kind of recently. But I kind of bounce around a little bit. Like I think like the one thing we can do with our social is that, you know, we talked about our brain and like self-talk, but we can do that with our social.
So
stuff that I kind of follow on my social kind of gives me the ability to be able to do that. So I'm kind of into his stuff right now, kind of looking through that and then I listen to a lot of podcasts. So, you know, outside of the Instagram stuff, it's more podcast stuff. Michael Gervais on you know, he's been a consistent one since I think he started his podcast in 2012 maybe. So follow his stuff really closely.
Yeah, that's good. No, it's that's the algorithm is a good thing. I'm glad mine is pretty healthy. I get motivational stuff every day that I just can't, like, it's picked up and it's pretty clean. So I'm pretty happy about that. Not going to erase it. It was hard to get to that point. biggest pet peeve as a person?
People that say what they want to do, but then don't do it.
Mm. Advice from older self to younger self.
You're gonna achieve greater things than you could ever dream of. Stay with it and keep being yourself.
Best worthwhile personal investment you've made.
I took a speaking class. It was a 6-month speaking class that I took. It was one of the best things I was able to do. It was great because the people that I got to interact with, you know, one thing in sport is you only interact with, athletes and people that think like athletes. For me to get into a room with creatives, and I'm a creative, you know, I was writing short stories in colleges for awards and was going to be a newspaper writer. And, you know, I'm a creative, you know, and I'm now I'm a basketball coach. So I'm trying to create in that space. But to sit with other people who are true creatives, you know, they make their money and their living off of being creative, off of speaking on stages and different advice, different technologies that they've built and, you know, different stuff like that. Like that was a really great investment. Mm-hmm. It really taught me to think differently. It showed me that I could fit in other rooms, where, you know, you don't always feel like you know, you can do that. You know what I mean? Like until you sit there and then you sit down and you go, wow, like it's all leadership. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've been a leader for 12 years I've been a CEO of a company for 12 years, you know, or, you know, and a lot of these people are aspiring to have that sort of leadership, you know? So you kind of feel like this is where I fit into the world mm-hmm. a little bit differently. So it was just an incredible experience to do that.
That is cool. What's something you believe in that other people think is crazy?
That's a tough one. Something that we believe in that other people think are crazy. I believe we can get to 40% from three and rebound 40% of our misses. Crazy.
That's a good one. That's a full circle moment right there.
I think we can be the first 40-40 if we could just tag up at the right level 90% of the time, you know? real coach's answer. No, you know, I really believe that each of us are more talented than we believe. We do need some luck. We do need to work. But I think the biggest thing that you got to do is you got to believe that the universe is at work for you. And I think the world tries to tell us that the world is against you. But I think you got to tell yourself that the world is here for you. And I think that sounds a bit crazy.
Yeah, there is a lot of cynicism out there, and you just gotta you gotta fight that for sure. Last question, Tim Ferriss question. I've been stealing today. I've been stealing from Modern Wisdom, Chris Williamson, Ali Abdaal. So Tim Ferriss question: what's your favorite failure that you look back on? It was hard, but it's kind of your favorite failure because that's what you learned the most from.
My first marriage.
Okay.
First marriage, not a great husband, just not great. You know, I mean, you marry young, you try to figure some things out along the way. I learned more about myself, good and bad in those moments. I would say number one would definitely be that, I think there's, you know, in marriage, you learn compromise. And, you know, to fail in a marriage is to be, A, the decision to marry that person, and no matter how wonderful they are, you know, that's a big decision. And maybe underestimating how big a decision that was, you know, when you're planning on spending a lifetime with somebody, sounds pretty simple. So, you know, just, I learned a ton there. And then I would also say, I got fired at GW. I call it a forced sabbatical, you know, because when you're in education, you know, they take sabbaticals all the time. So they, you know, I was put on a forced sabbatical. And I learned there that, you know, like, yeah, I walked into a situation, you know, I'd basically rebuilt all these teams, you know, Mount St. Mary's, Siena. And I walked into a situation thinking that I could rebuild that in the same way that I rebuilt the other ones. And, you know, 32 months into it, they were like, no, this rebuild is over. And so just recognizing that, you know, look, I say this all the time, I'm not Jesus. Okay. I'm not Jesus. You know, I'm made in his image, but I'm not Jesus. And so sometimes some opportunities are bigger issues than what you think, you know, and, you know, not everyone is going to be accepting of who you are and your messaging and how you want to be. And it's okay, you know, but learning that kind of lesson and learning the warning signs before you walk into a situation like that, I learned that a ton, because the warning signs were all there. You sort of have a level of arrogance that you're going to be able to correct some things, that sometimes some foundational things you're just not going to be able to correct. And so having the wisdom to still trust your instincts after making a poor decision, I think is, you know, one of the most important things you can learn.
Yeah. Well, Jamin, you're not Jesus, but you are a Christian. I enjoyed this conversation, man. It was a great one. I'm enjoying watching you from the outside. I enjoyed watching you happy winning the first game in the cup, and it was like something that, you know, we haven't met, you know, that's the first time we've talked, so it felt like it was as fluid as it gets, and absolutely. I'm glad we got to do this.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you having me on, and keep shouting the good, man. We need it in the world, and I appreciate you, and stay safe.
Thank you. Thank you. Stay safe, everybody. Peace.